represent the appellant Brady Edwards Spear in this matter. Problems with the pretest observation period were the core issues in this case. On the count that Spear was convicted of, the jury's focus was placed on those deficiencies in the observation period. That was the reasonable doubt that was to undermine the validity of the testing method, repeated in the jigs, repeated in argument. So there's two issues in this case closely intertwined. There was the litigation regarding the foundational reliability of the test itself, which was
On that point, Mr. Kohler, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of Judge Shellhouse's decision in Junker, since you argued it. Doesn't that foreclose your first argument based on the facts, which seem to be remarkably similar to the facts in Junker?
I think the facts in this case are even stronger than the facts that were in Junker, in that the officer explicitly said there were no competing officers testifying almost against one another. The officer here did say that without a proper observation period, the results are not valid. And then a couple pages later in the transcript.
Well, I mean, you know, who cares what he said? I mean, Judge Shellhouse is the one who wrote the opinion. I mean, don't you have the burden to prove there was, burping or belching? And if there's no indication of that, I'm just kind of reading Judge Shellhouse's opinion. I mean, don't you lose?
Well, two things. First, in an implied consent case, and Junker, a petition for further review was filed either yesterday or today, but it is good law right now. And in an implied consent case under Junker, yes. And I briefly raised that in appellant's brief, that there is this confusion between issues in implied consent cases and in criminal proceedings. And there is a lot of prior implied consent case law on point that talks about this burden shifting and how deficiencies in the observation period always go to the weight, especially in an implied consent hearing, which effectively means lose. In this case, there were facts that were never present, to my understanding, in any of those prior cases. And so we're raising it strictly as an evidentiary foundational reliability type of challenge. It is reviewed for abuse of discretion, where many of those cases are reviewed as it's decided as a matter of law in the implied consent context. Here we're saying on this record, the evidence that was presented to the judge, the officer's own testimony, basically said this test lacks foundational reliability because I didn't conduct the proper observation period. That, I think, is governed by State v. Dilley, which says without that foundational reliability, the results aren't probative, they're irrelevant. And irrelevant evidence shouldn't be presented to a jury. It did get presented to the jury, and that brought up the second point, the confusion that happened when the state shifted the burden and referenced some evidence that wasn't in the record, specifically the manual, told the jury that there was more evidence for them to consider in terms of weighing this deficient observation period, but the defendant, effectively implying the defendant hid it from them. And I know the state has conceded that, yes, that was misconduct. I bring it up just to emphasize how pervasive it was throughout the trial, this specific point.
We would still review that misconduct, did you agree, under a harmless error standard?
Yes, I did not argue that it was reversible per se. It was only mentioned once. That one mention was, if we're counting pages, there were four pages of state's closing argument that dealt with the per se count, the one that Spear was convicted of, not acquitted of. And it was about half a page of those four pages. When the state, the panel may be aware, when the state mentions the non-exhaustive list of times that the manual was mentioned at trial, four of those five aren't actually references to the manual dealing with the observation period, because there were a lot of manuals referenced in this trial. The jury heard lots of evidence from the standard field sobriety test manual. They never asked to see that manual, and they actually acquitted Spear on the count where the field sobriety tests mattered. Two of the references in respondent's brief, page 153 of the transcript and 235 of the transcript, are actually references to the field sobriety manual. So that had nothing to do with the misconduct in this case. And similarly, because the jury didn't just ask for the manual, they specifically wanted the procedures dealing with the observation period. The two other transcript references to 350 and 352, those also had nothing to do with the observation period. So it emphasizes that in the grand scheme of trial, this was a big deal. The fact that the misconduct happened and the jury actually came back with a question specifically dealing with where the burden was shifted, I think makes this a clear-cut case. And we didn't raise reversible per se as a standard because I do think it absolutely meets the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. I don't think there's any way to say that in this case it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. At a minimum, I'm asking this panel to remand this case for a new trial for that reason. In addition, asking the court to find that it was abuse of discretion under the facts of this case to hold that this test result was even admissible. And if the court does that, I'll be asking for that count to be dismissed. There won't be evidence to proceed forward without the actual test results. So that's what appellant is asking for. If there's no more questions from the panel, I'll reserve my remaining argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May I proceed?
Please, thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris White, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I guess starting with the observation period, I think the court was correct that there are other indications of reliability in that case kind of settles the issue of admissibility for an imperfect observation period. I would push back some on the suggestion that the officer conceded an imperfect observation period automatically means the test is unreliable and can't come in. I will acknowledge that both Sergeant Otto and Officer Pretzlov, when they're being cross-examined, say yes to whether or not it's an essential scientific test. But after Pretzlov has reviewed the DMT manual overnight, the next day, when he's asked that question again, he pushes back. He doesn't say it's an essential test. He just says it's important. And I think it's important for the court to focus on why that observation period is important, and it's to make sure that there's no mouth alcohol interfering with the test. And the officer testified to a myriad of other ways beyond having a perfect observation period in this case that could satisfy the district court that the test was reliable, specifically the O2 agreement, the invalid breath test, declining mouth alcohol sample, and the fact that once you get to the jail, you get searched, and he starts the observation period, the individual doesn't have the ability to put an item into their mouth that could affect the breath test. So I think for those reasons, it's well within the court's discretion to admit that test as reliable. And as far as arguing about the observation period, that's a matter of weight that can go to the jury. They're certainly entitled to argue to the jury. They did vigorously in this case. The jury is instructed that that is something they are to consider when determining if that test is reliable. And it's well within the jury's purview, given the evidence in this case, to find that test reliable and the district court's discretion to admit that test.
Mr. White, who has the burden of proving if there was not a proper observation period? Who has the burden of proving whether something went wrong in that observation period if the officer concedes he wasn't observing the person with the machine? I mean, do you have to prove does the defendant have to prove, or does Mr. Kohler have to prove that there was a problem even if no one was observing, or do you have to prove, or is it the reverse?
I don't know that I would characterize it necessarily as a burden, although that may be the most appropriate. I would characterize it as there needs to be some evidence that something was wrong. And in this case, as the transcript is clear from Officer Pretzlov's testimony, there is no evidence that something was wrong with the test. The O2 agreement was met. And there wasn't an invalid declining mouth alcohol
let
result.
Let me ask you a question, and maybe I've got this backwards here. In looking at one of the memos, it said the testing variance is 0.086, 0.090, and 0.080. Did you find that someplace?
I guess I don't know exactly what you're referring to. There is on the testing printout, there would be a breath test. I believe the first result was a 0.090. Then there should be a control sample. And then there should be another breath test, which I believe was a 0.086. So that the control test, where it tests against a known sample, might be what the court's referring to.
I ask that because, what the 0.080 is pretty darn close.
And the way that they actually get to that 0.080, which was explained to the jury, is they take the two tests, they take the lower of the two tests, and they cut off the third number. So that's why it comes out as just a 0.086. Or, sorry, just a 0.08.
Mr. White, why would we assume harmless error in this case when the jury actually seemed to ask a question about the manual? I mean, that would suggest it was playing some part in their deliberations.
And I wouldn't describe it as the courts assuming that there's harmless error. I think that if you look at the record as a whole...
Well, I guess why should we assume it's not?
Right. I think that you can find that it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I regret now that I did not put an exhaustive list of all of the DMT references. I did go back through after writing that brief and count. And yes, not all of the references are to the manual, specifically about the observation period. But the majority of them are, and aside from that one passing comment during closing argument, there were 24 other references, not all of which were the DMT manual, but a good chunk of them were, throughout the course of the trial. Over the 2 days, the jury repeatedly saw the attorneys using the manual and questioning witnesses with the manual. They multiple occasions saw attorneys going up to the witness and refreshing the recollection by having the witness read the manual. So the idea that a very brief passing comment during close, which wasn't even trying to address that issue, it was trying to address visual observation versus other observation, I don't think it's reasonable to conclude that given all of the other references throughout the trial, the fact that the jury knew that those manuals were in the courtroom, that the attorneys had access to them, that the reason that they asked for it is because there was a brief passing reference to it during the beginning of the state's close.
I'll just ask you, would the strongest argument as to why we would believe it's not harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt is because when asked, the district court responded and said, no, it's not in evidence. You have all the evidence. You should decide the case based on your recollection of the witness's testimony. So should we just cite to that and say, well, we presume juries follow instructions, so...
I mean, I don't think that by any means is exclusive. I think it is one thing the court can cite to, but the way that this is examined...
What else, that appeals to me, so
which
I don't
think
it will appeal to my colleagues,
but I think it's
what else have you got besides that instruction?
It's a strong argument, but aside from the instructions that we presume juries follow them, we look to all the evidence as a whole. So there's one passing comment over here. There's multiple lengthier references to the manual throughout the trial. There was some mention in their brief about... they assumed that that wasn't in and that's the only way they could come to their verdict. I'd submit that that's not true. There was multiple other evidence for them to rely on regarding whether or not that breath test would be accurate. Again, the things I've already mentioned, the 0.02 agreement, the invalid sample from declining mouth alcohol, and the fact that they're searched and don't have the ability to put anything in their mouth. So I think if you look at the reference or all of the case as a whole, including the instruction, including the other times that it's referenced properly, which are much lengthier and more abundant and more in detail than the brief reference during close, that it becomes the only reasonable option is that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I just want to be clear, I understand your argument. Assume that there is no observation exercised by the officer. Your position is that there's no period of observation at all, even aside from the argument in this case that there was a brief opportunity for the burping or vomiting to have occurred. Is it your position that that the test can be deemed reliable on other bases?
I would not go that far. I don't think you need to come anywhere close to that for this court. And I don't think necessarily the case law would support that no observation period is satisfactory. There is references to cases in the briefs about when an officer doesn't understand at all why they're doing an observation period. I think that would be closer to not doing one at all.
So why would an inadequate observation period, a breach, a failure to observe during part of the observation period, not face the same problem?
And I guess I don't, inadequate might be a fair way to phrase it. I would go more with imperfect. And at least in this case, you've got enough of the observation period with the officer also saying, yeah, I couldn't see him. I can normally hear people in that room. I didn't hear anything. And here are these other three ways that we can have some confidence that it's reliable in this case. And again, I'd stress this is within the judge's discretion. So the judge the district court judge is in the best position to evaluate all of that and decide if, under those circumstances, it's reliable. And in this case, I think that's within his discretion to do, given what was testified to about why they have that belief in this case.
So we're only talking, correct me if I'm wrong, about a 15-minute period of time where they would be observing him.
That's the minimum required, yes.
Okay. That's the minimum requirement?
Yes, that's what the machine requires before it will let you take a sample.
But someone should be in that room with that person, I mean, with the belching and all this other stuff that possibly could go on. And we don't know what may have happened during that interim.
Right, we don't know because there wasn't direct observation, and I would say it's best practice that that happens. It would be my preference that that happens, but under Minnesota law, I don't think it is a requirement. And while we don't directly know, as I previously mentioned, we have other indications to tell us that nothing happened, as far as we can tell.
So help me then, what is the requirement for observation?
I don't know that under our current case law there is a hard and fast requirement. It's a best practice of do it 15 minutes. They testify that it's important to do a 15-minute observation
period.
Where
does 15 minutes come from?
I believe that comes from their field training. It wasn't explicit in the transcript, but I think that's what they've determined is a safe level that if you had mouth alcohol, it would dissipate.
I'm wondering how it is that this observation period could be deemed reliable if there is an admission by the administering officer that there was an opportunity during the lack of observation moments for there to have been the actual occurrence of the thing that the observation period is supposed to be watching out for, burping, mouth vomiting, and so forth.
And that's an understandable question. I would say that we're not talking, when we're talking about the admission of the breath test, we're not talking about a reliable observation period. We're talking about, do we have a reason to think that the way the test was administered is reliable? And so we have the observation period, and then we have the, if hypothetically, since he wasn't looking at him, he could have burped, he could have soundlessly burped. We do have testimony that not every time you burp causes mouth alcohol. And again, we have those other independent things from the machine itself that if one of those things happened and there was mouth alcohol, should catch it.
Then why do you concede, as you have earlier, that no recognizing or observing the subject not at all, failing to observe for any period, would be a failure of foundation?
I think it would be well within the judge's discretion to find it as a failure of foundation.
I thought you had acknowledged that that would not be, that that would necessarily render the test unreliable if there was no observation period exercise.
I think that's what the case law supports. But the case law doesn't support a relatively good but imperfect observation period. And we're not talking about it always comes in. Their argument is, per se, if there's a mistake in the observation period, it's gone, period. And I don't think that's what Minnesota law supports.
Well, why is it, as a matter of policy, that the test would be, per se, inadmissible for lack of foundation if there's no observation period?
I would say because at some point, it's just so deficient in the procedures that are outlined to try and protect it.
Why?
I'm not a scientist. I can't draw the line. That's what the case law
suggests. Doesn't it reasonably suggest that it's because there's a possibility that this sort of thing happened, burping, mouth vomiting, occurred during that period in which there was no observation? Isn't that the reason?
There is certainly a possibility, but given the evidence that came into trial in this case, I don't think it is a plausible
belief. That's what I'm getting as a matter of principle, though. If the reason, no observation period at all, the reason that that would be enough to invalidate the test as being unreliable, I'm trying to get a sense of why that same basis wouldn't apply, why that same reasoning wouldn't apply if there was observation, but it was ineffective in the sense that there was a period where the very circumstance could have occurred because of a failure to observe.
And I guess I don't have a direct answer, because I'm not a scientist, and I don't let the record is developed enough in this case to answer that. But there could very well be, at some point, it can become reliable if, depending on what other observations come in. It is very fact-specific currently under the case law to the case. And so I don't know that this is a developed enough record for me to be able to draw you a line. I don't have that information, given where we are with this case.
Well, I'm just looking for a sort of a logical argument as opposed to a scientific, factual one.
I guess we would recognize, in my mind, that people make mistakes. They can be imperfect. That doesn't always mean that we're going to throw it out. But at some point, you've made enough mistakes that it's just not reliable. And a brief interruption in the observation period is not that point, where completely forgetting to do it very well could be that point.
I'm just trying to get a sense of, as a matter of logic, why, if it's the, we're not talking about punishing the officer for not doing its job, we're talking about the reliability of the test. Can we trust the test results? And if an observation period is required, I'm trying to get a sense of why, if the failure in the observation period to have actually observed the concerns and paid attention to the types of concerns that are at issue, why it matters whether it was a brief failure or a perpetual failure to observe.
And to be frank, I'm just not well-versed enough in the law and the science to be able to give you a direct answer on that.
What about the logic of it?
I mean, beyond what I've expressed, I don't know enough to try and make it more logical than that. I apologize. I guess barring any other questions, I'd cede my time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Kohler, you'll have the last word, sir.
May it please the court. The court's questions for respondents' counsel kind of emphasizes the problem we've got with in the civil case law. The burden-shifting scheme that's been developed works because it's a civil case. You can put that burden on the opposing party and shift things around. Here, it's not an affirmative defense to challenge the testing method. And that's why, to the court's point, like logically at least, it does make sense for a district court judge to say, yeah, under the facts of this case, this test lacks foundational reliability. I mean, it's a decision that's made many times before trial and during trial by district court judges because they're in the best position to decide that on a case-by-case basis.
So you agree that it's a case-by-case basis in the sense that if there is some deficiency in the observation period, a brief failure to observe, that would not per se invalidate a test based upon foundational grounds?
I think that if there's a straight-up break in the observation period, like it is an abuse of discretion not to suppress that test. There's lots of observation periods where
you
the officers...
You say a straight-up break. What's the difference between a momentary failure to observe and a straight-up break? Is there a difference?
I'd equate them as the same thing. And again, this is me talking as me. There's many observation periods where the officer is working on reports or filling out paperwork in the same room within X amount of distance from the individual. That's very common. In that situation, that is an observation period. And I mean, and the defense attorney is crying out because we like to call it a deprivation period because it's more than just observing. It's about depriving them of the option to do that. But I'll refrain from saying that again.
You're too late.
After I say it. But no,
that's a new one for me, the deprivation period. I have to remember that. I have to find some way to get someone to put that in the opinion.
But in any event, like when there's a break in the observation period, and the officer actually leaves the room, and the person isn't under observation. And there's admissions that everybody knows that people can burp without being so audible that you hear them in the next room. And when we know that these individuals many times don't know what they can and can't do, probably won't think twice if they do burp. I mean, under those situations in a criminal case, I think under State v. Dilley, the test results shouldn't come in. And it shouldn't be presented to the jury. And it is different in a civil case. And under Junker, even if we show that the person burped, there's still an additional burden that's placed upon the petitioner. But I think here...
Why isn't the opportunity for cross-examination sufficient to safeguard concerns that you raise in this case?
I think because it does get very confusing for the jury. I mean, they asked the question, they wanted to see that manual. I think that it absolutely was because of the comment by the state implying that the defendant was hiding the ball on the observation period. It's not as important as you think. You should see the manual. But in this case, getting into that, it's almost like a trial, or it's a battle of the experts without an expert. And it comes to that core gatekeeping role that
But if there's an acknowledgement, it's clear on the record that the jury was aware that burping or mouth vomiting could affect the test results, and there was opportunity to cross-examine as to whether or not the state is certain that that didn't occur. Why isn't that enough to get at least to the jury, for the jury to weigh the relative weight of the argument, the possibility that the lapse in the observation period was sufficient or insufficient to invalidate or to render unreliable or at least less credible the test results?
Yeah, no, and I understand exactly where the court's coming from. My position in that context would be, you know, that gatekeeper role of judges under 702 when it comes to scientific evidence, because as a logical, practical matter, you're always going to have jurors jumping in and saying, well, why doesn't Mr. Spear testify and tell us, did he burp or not? Like, it's not an explicit burden shifting, but it's implicitly there, and that's very common when it comes to forensic evidence. And I think that's why the standard is, if it lacks foundational reliability, we don't even get into that fight with the fact finder.
I'm just talking about if it's a close case of reliability, foundational reliability. Those are arguments that are generally presented to the jury. The court lets it in, recognizing it's weak, that there are weaknesses in the foundation which can be tested, or not in the foundation, but weaknesses in the reliability. It seems like this is isn't an area of great scientific expertise necessary, in the idea that if you mouth vomit and if you've consumed alcohol, that it's going to affect the test, and in fact there was testimony to that effect here.
No, and I see that I'm out of time.
Please answer the question. Thank you.
No, I mean, and that's why if I wish this was reviewed de novo instead of abuse of discretion, because it is, there is a lot of that gray area. But, and again, I'll just emphasize, I think under the specific facts of this case, the evidence that was given to the judge is that this test was invalid if the observation period was improper, and the officer did say the observation period is improper whenever you break it, and then admitted that he broke it. So I think that even though abuse of discretion is a tough standard, I think it's met here, and would ask the court to reverse on those grounds as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler. Thank you, Mr. White. The matter is submitted.